books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
In association with RNIB Talking Books, this is Read On, the audiobook show. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and coming up today, we've got another Funny People special, as we'll be chatting to comedians Richard Herring, Joe Caulfield, and comedic actor and Neil in the Young Ones, Nigel Planer. All that, plus we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library, coming up on today's Read On. Joe Caulfield is an award-winning comedian. She's appeared on Have I Got News For You, Mock the Week, Michael McIntyre's Comedy Roadshow, and on Radio 4, The News Quiz, The Now Show, The Unbelievable Truth, and her own comedy stand-up shows. Jo was at the Wigtown Book Festival with her memoir, The Funny Thing About Death. 6 years ago, Jo Caulfield was about to go on stage when she found out that her big sister Annie had cancer. Not the best way to start a nationwide comedy tour, but the tour turns out to be a welcome distraction for both sisters. Jo will join me in a moment to tell me more, but now let's hear from the audiobook, read by Jo herself.
She was 4.5 years older than me, so I have never known a world without Annie. She was already here, ahead of me, being exciting, inventing games and making up stories. One of my earliest memories is of lying in bed and Annie pointing into the sky on Christmas Eve. "There's Santa and his reindeers," she said. I jumped up to see them, and there they were. Santa on a sleigh, soaring through the starry night sky. Who needed hallucinogenic drugs when your older sister could make you see things? The power of a big sister is mighty, but it makes for an unreliable narrator. Purple Smarties were poisonous. The Virgin Mary appeared to her in the bathroom. If I cut my hair, it would grow back blonde. I did, and it didn't. And David Cassidy was her brother. Yes, 70s TV's David Cassidy. He was busy filming The Partridge Family, but visited her whenever he could, she said. It seemed logical. Who wouldn't rather live in California than on an Air Force base in Norfolk? I soon realised that I should believe much of what Annie said in the same way that I believed Shirley Jones was David Cassidy's mother. I knew it wasn't true, but it didn't stop me enjoying the show.
It started as sort of a way of getting things out of my head, basically, when my sister Annie died of cancer. And then I was sort of doing a blog and putting them up on my website, and then it was the comedian Sarah Millican. She was doing a magazine, an online magazine then, and she said, "Oh, Joe, put the pieces in our magazine," and then sort of feedback from people about it, you know, that they were relating to it, and so then I started writing more stuff, and then it was just memories of my sister Annie, and she was very funny. She was a writer as well. So when I was writing it, I felt very close to her. It was actually, people said, "Oh, is it a hard thing?" And actually, it was like spending time with her. It's like when you lose someone, if you talk to friends and relatives about that person, it's the only way you can have of sort of feeling close to them. So in that way, and then it just sort of spread, and I thought of more stories, and then I realised, oh, I could put in some of her work. Particularly shorter pieces, because she had written all sorts, but quite a lot of sort of funny pieces for magazines and stuff. So I put some of those in, which was then a way to talk about her or whatever she was talking about in that piece. And that's a way of keeping her going. So I thought that was a great thing to do as well. And also all of the money for the book is going to Macmillan Cancer Support, because I thought, well, I couldn't profit from it. And also they were so wonderful with Annie that I know she would appreciate that, because she would want to give something back, so she would like that. So the book is like a memoir of sort of two odd girls growing up in the sort of 60s and 70s and coming to London sort of early 80s and trying to get into different things, you know, but sort of unconventional. I was in a band and she was trying to be a writer, and then I did a lot of waitressing and then eventually became a comedian. So it's that, but also then going through the process of grief and that weird way that it hits you when you're not expecting it. And I sort of had friends who would take me out for drinks, and it was almost like they're prodding you, trying to make you cry. And I could see that they're very disappointing with me, that I don't seem to be crying. But then it would be odd moments where sometimes it's music. Or one time it was I was on tour and I had to change trains. And the train was meant to go to London from Bristol. And then an announcement came up and said, oh, we've got to change at Didcot Parkway. And I just started crying. It was just like, my sister's dead and now I've got to change trains. And the man at the station obviously thought I was crying because I had to change trains. So he was so sweet and really explained in a really slow way how you change trains. And I was just crying then because he was being so nice to me. And then it was weird. Then I got out at Didcot Parkway and I was like, well, do you know what? It's not that easy to change there, actually. So it was sort of odd things like that and questions you don't expect. I remember the first time someone asked me, do you have a brother and a sister? And I had to say, and it took me completely by surprise because I had said, oh, my God, I got a sister, but she died. And that has never happened again. But when it happens the first time, it was really upsetting. And then I worried that that would keep happening. Mm. And then you realise, oh, you don't have to answer. Depends who it is. And like my little neighbour, who's 9, was like, oh, do you have brothers and sisters? So obviously I'm not going to tell a 9-year-old, well, I had a sister and she died. You just gloss over it, you know. But at the time, it's one of those things that sort of sticks. So sort of things about that, about grief. But also, I think in a positive way, how... I think my sister left me people. She left me her friends and her partner, and we kind of looked after each other. And I've gained them in my life as sort of gifts from her. And also raising money for Macmillan and being any kind of fundraising, you realise, oh, there's this huge network of people that will help you. And also in the grief club as well. Sometimes it's just knowing that somebody else feels it. And I didn't realise... Oh, there's this club, millions of people, and they get it, and they understand what you're going through, and that is a comfort to everybody. So in a way, I hope it's sort of funny and hopeful as well, as obviously being sad.
Oswald Twistle, pronounced Ozzle Twizzle. That's where I was when I found out that Annie was ill. I was in the middle of a stand-up comedy tour. I thought the name sounded like a character from Dickens. Mrs. Ozzletwizzle, always fussing and will never get her inheritance. But it's actually an old mill town that had been the home of James Hargreaves, the inventor of the spinning jenny. This was a fact that had lain dormant in my brain since O-level history, and it made me strangely excited to be there, like meeting a celebrity, the spinning jenny man. My show at Ozzletwizzle hadn't sold well, so I'd booked myself into the poshest hotel in the area. I like to double down on financial disaster if ticket sales are slow. The hotel room was one of those ones that looks good but is actually completely impractical and badly designed. Design has nothing to do with price. Cheap chain hotels like Travelodge and Days Inn have very well designed rooms. Ibis have those weird moulded bathrooms that, although perfectly functional, always make me feel that I'm on a cruise ship. A cruise ship that is way off course going through Doncaster.
You were about to kick off a stand-up tour when you got the initial email from your sister saying, OK, this is happening.
Yeah.
Was that in the back of your head when you were on stage? Was it hard trying to be funny when you knew this process had started?
It's funny how your brain just clicks in. I suppose it's like anyone at work. You're going, well, I'm at work. And I felt, oh, I'm lucky that at least I like my work. So when I was on stage, I had that little kick of adrenaline that helped me through. And then it would be afterwards, the travelling, the being in a hotel on your own, that did become harder to the point where a little while I thought, I'm not going to tour on my own for quite a while because I'm not as resilient as I was before she died. But I'm about actually to just start doing a tour for the first time since she died, but because that became harder. But I think I'd be okay with it now. But it is funny how you could still, you know, your brain puts things in little compartments, doesn't it? But at the same time, it's always in the back of your head, yeah.
Storytelling or lying is quite a skill. You can't just jump into it. I learned this lesson early in life, a very valuable one, considering that years later I would become a comedian. Conditions need to be right. You need to know your audience. When I was about 6 years old, Annie 10 or 11 and our brother James 8, we were playing on a bit of wasteland on the RAF camp. The ground was muddy and had dried hard into a crazy paving pattern. James and I were following Annie, putting our feet neatly onto each dry slab. trying not to touch the edges. That was the game. This was a familiar order in our childhood. Annie, James, and then me. Annie said, "Don't leave your foot on too long, or the cracked edge will separate and you'll fall all the way down to Africa. You'll land in the Sahara Desert." What an amazing thought. I could completely imagine this piece of dry mud whooshing down cartoon style through the earth and then suddenly popping up with me on it in Africa. In fact, Journey to the Centre of the Earth was one of my favourite films at the time. I had loved the scenes of people walking through galleries of molten rock. We all hopped much more quickly from one slab to the next, now with the added danger of being whooshed to Africa. It was that non-threatening danger that made you slightly hysterical with laughter. Laughing would slow you down, which made you laugh even more as you knew you had to keep hopping, but you couldn't keep hopping because you were laughing so much.
You read the audio version of the book. How was that?
Yes. Now, first of all, it was a thing I'd never done, so I was really lucky with the engineer sort of helped me. He said, "Well, let's start, and then I'll probably get you to redo the beginning." And that was exactly it, because it takes you a while to work out, well, what's my voice? How do I talk? So he said, "No, now it sounds like you're being yourself, so we'll go back and do the first chapter again." And there was only one moment that I had to stop that was really emotional. Because I'd rewritten the book so much, I was sort of familiar with it, but there was one bit that's just really, really sad and hit me. And so I kind of had to stop. But I was surprised there weren't more moments like that that I did sort of mostly manage. Because again, you're sort of putting your brain into, I'm at work now, so I mustn't be emotional. But there was one bit where I was like, oh, I just can't. And also it was, I know it sounds weird, but I enjoyed it because I enjoyed the book, which I don't know if that's a really arrogant thing to say, but I was like, oh, I'm really enjoying this book that I happen to have written. So that was odd and I saw what was funny. That was good to read it out loud and go, oh, no, that is funny. But I suppose that's the comedian in me was going, oh, where is the joke? Oh, no, there is a joke. That's good. And also you notice it was actually very good that I did the audio before the book had been published, because I noticed a couple of little sentences where I thought, oh, that doesn't sound good when it's read out. So I changed it, corrected things. And two times there was information, and the editor hadn't seen this, and nor had I, the information the reader needed. And I thought, oh, they don't know that happened, so they don't understand that. So I had to go back and put in just that little piece of information. So in that way, I thought, it's a really good check on a book before you publish is to do the audio of it.
A little while later, I was playing in that same area without Annie. I was with Julie and Dawn Troughton, who lived across from us and were a bit younger than me. I told them about the cracked, crazy paving mud and how it would open up and we would end up in Africa. But it didn't work the same way as when Annie said it. They went crazy. Julie became hysterical, but not in the good laughing way. Then, as she stared terrified at the screaming Julie, Dawn started frantically yelling, "Get me off! Get me off!" The grassy area was only about 20 feet away, but Dawn just kept jumping up and down on the spot, which, if the story had been true, was exactly the wrong thing to do. I told them it was made up, that it wasn't true, but they wouldn't believe me. They just kept bawling. So I had to physically pick up Dawn and half drag, half carry her to safety. I lay on the grass waiting for them both to calm down so we could play some more, but they wanted to go home. Next thing I knew, their mother was glaring at me like I was some kind of maniac. "Why would you say such a horrid thing, Joe?" Julie was still crying, rocking back and forth. Jesus, it was just a story. I knew it was a story when Annie said it to me. So how did they not know it was a story? A scary, fun story.
The Funny Thing About Death, written and read by Joe Caulfield, is available commercially.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books library. So here are two new gems. New in the library, we have the latest by award-winning Ali Smith. It's called Glyph.
Our mother came down to the docking gate to say cheerio to us. For a moment, I didn't recognise her. I thought she was just a woman working at the hotel. She had her hair scraped back off her face and tied in a ponytail. And she was wearing clothes so unlike her, and so not quite right for her shape, that it took me that moment to work out they were her sister's work clothes. The uniform they made the women and girls here wear, white shirt, long black pinafore apron skirt thing. The men and boys who worked here got to look more casual. Their uniform was designer jeans and white t-shirts made of stuff that was better than what ordinary t-shirts get made of. The women and girls weren't allowed makeup or earrings or necklaces. Our mother looked smaller, duller, scrubbed clean and cloistery, like serving women from humbled countries look in films on TV.
Once upon a time, not very far from now, two children come home to find a line of wet red paint encircling the outside of their house. What does it mean? It's a truism of our time that it will be the next generation who will sort out our increasingly toxic world. But what would that actually be like? In a state turned hostile, a world of insiders and outsiders, what things of the past can sustain them and what shape can resistance take? And what's a horse got to do with any of this? Glyph is a novel about how we make meaning and how we are made meaningless, with a nod to the traditions of dystopian fiction, a glance at the Kafkaesque, and a new take on the notion of classic. It's a moving and electrifying read, a vital and prescient tale of the versatility and variety deep-rooted in language, in nature, and in human nature.
How's she doing today? Leif asked. How long will she be ill? My own sister asked. Our mother gave my sister a look for being rude. 2 weeks, Leif said. 3? As long as till September? The faraway word September hung in the air around us in the weird tradespeople space. My sister looked at her feet. Leif looked at the walls, concrete and stone, the huge lit candles in the glass jars burning pointless against the daylight. Christ? He said. He said it like a question. Our mother shook her head, nodded her head, nodded from one to the other of the two statues the hotel had on either side of the docking entrance, shook her head again, then put her finger to her mouth as if to smooth the place beneath her nose. Graceful, but really to quieten Leif and us. They were life-size, the statues, substantial white stone shining. They looked churchy. They looked related, but they were separate. One was of a sad-looking, beautiful woman with a cloth round her head, exactly like a Virgin Mary with her arms cupped, open and empty, one hand upturned and her eyes downturned, closed or gazing down at her own empty lap, at nothing but the folds in her clothes. The other was the bent body of a man. He was obviously meant to be dead. His head turned to one side, his arms and legs meant to look limp. But the angle he was at on the floor made him look stiff and awkward, sprawled but frozen. Leif gave him a push, and he rocked from side to side. Our mother looked panicked.
Glyph by Ali Smith is read by Elliot Summer and runs for 4 hours and 58 minutes.
Recently, we received another book by customer favourite Santa Montefiore. It's called Meet Me Under the Ombu Tree, and was given to us by Simon & Schuster.
When I close my eyes, I see the flat, fertile plains of the Argentine Pampa. It is like no other place on earth. The vast horizon stretches out for miles and miles. We used to sit at the top of the ombu tree and watch the sun disappear behind it, flooding the plains with honey. As a child, I was unaware of the political chaos around me. Those were the days of General Perón's exile. Turbulent years from 1955 to 73, when the military ruled the country like incompetent schoolchildren playing pass the parcel with political power. They were dark days of guerrilla warfare and terrorism. But Santa Catalina, Our ranch was a small oasis of peace, far from the riots and oppression taking place in the capital. From the top of our magical tree, we gazed lovingly down onto a world of old-fashioned values and traditional family life, punctuated with horse riding, polo, and long, languorous barbecues in the dazzling summer sunshine. The bodyguards were the only indications of the trouble that simmered on our borders.
Sofia Solanas grows up on a beautiful ranch in the middle of the Argentine Pampa. In a world of old-fashioned values, she carves out a place as a rebellious and passionate young woman, but eventually her stubborn nature leads her to trouble. When Sofia's mother, Anna, discovers that Sofia has embarked on a forbidden love affair, she must act in order to save the family from shame. She sends Sofia to Europe, away from her friends and family and the man Sofia loves. But then, more than 20 years later, a family tragedy calls Sofia home, and she must discover if her passion still lives on.
My grandfather, Dermot O'Dwyer, never did believe in the magic of the ombu tree. That's not to say he wasn't superstitious. He used to hide his liquor in a different place every night to fool the leprechauns. But he just didn't see how a tree could possess any kind of power. "A tree is a tree," he'd say in his Irish drawl, "and that's all there is to it." But he wasn't made from Argentine soil. Like his daughter, my mother, he was an alien and never did fit in. He didn't want to be buried in our family tomb either. "I came from the earth and to the earth I'll return," he was very fond of saying. So he was buried on the plain with his bottle of liquor. I guess he was still anxious to outsmart those leprechauns. I cannot think about Argentina without the craggy image of that tree, as wise and omniscient as an oracle, rising to the surface of my thoughts. I know now that one can never recapture the past, but that old tree holds all the memories of yesterday and the hopes invested in tomorrow within the very essence of its boughs. Like a rock in the middle of a river, the ombu has remained the same while all those around it have changed.
Meet Me Under the Ombu Tree by Santa Montefiore is read by Juanita McMahon and runs for 22 hours. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. And before I talk to my next guest at the Wigtown Book Festival, have a listen to this.
The twin city of Ankh-Morpork, foremost of all the cities bounding the Circle Sea, was, as a matter of course, the home of a large number of gangs, thieves' guilds, syndicates and similar organisations. This was one of the reasons for its wealth. Most of the humbler folk on the Widdershin side of the river, in Morpork's mazy alleys, supplemented their meagre incomes by filling some small role for one or other of the competing gangs. So it was that by the time Hugh and Twoflower entered the courtyard of the Broken Drum, the leaders of a number of them were aware that someone had arrived in the city who appeared to have much treasure. Some reports from the more observant spies included details about a book that told the stranger what to say, and a box that walked by itself. These facts were immediately discounted. No magician capable of such enchantments ever came within a mile of Morpork docks. It still being that hour when most of the city was just rising or about to go to bed, there were few people in the drum to watch Twoflower descend the stairs. When the luggage appeared behind him and started to lurch confidently down the steps, the customers at the rough wooden tables, as one man, looked suspiciously at their drinks. Broadman was browbeating the small troll who swept the bar when the trio walked past him.
"What in hell's that?" he said.
"Just don't talk about it," hissed Hugh.
Twoflower was already thumbing through his book.
"What's he doing?" said Broadman, arms akimbo.
It tells him what to say. I know it sounds ridiculous, muttered Hugh.
How can a book tell a man what to say?
I wish for an accommodation, a room, lodgings, the lodging house full board, are your rooms clean? A room with a view, what is your rate for one night? Said Two Flower in one breath. Broadman looked at Hugh. The beggar shrugged. He's got plenty money, he said.
Tell him it's 3 copper pieces, then, and that thing will have to go in the stable.
The next voice will be familiar to many listeners as the voice of the Discworld, Nigel Planer.
Hello, hello.
Now, I believe narrating Discworld was a sort of spark for Jeremiah Born in Time.
Yes, to some extent, yes. Narrating, I can't remember how many Discworld books I narrated, but it was quite a few, and I got to know the characters. I had whole lists of the character names and sort of casting suggestions so I wouldn't forget how each character spoke. It took some years. I must have done more than 15 of Terry Pratchett's Discworld books. I got to sort of know them quite well and know the characters quite well. And when it came to trying to find a voice and a right way to write my time travel story, I did find that I was very much inspired by Terry Pratchett's work, not least of all in the completely pointless footnotes, which I just love. The pedantry is maybe too much of a derisive word, but the sort of finickettiness of the footnotes and his general attitude as well, that I really found myself in tune with that. And I've written, there's quite a few footnotes in Jeremiah Born in Time. There's even a sort of subplot going on in the footnotes, which is a little sort of row between the author, i.e. me, and his editor, who gets fired or leaves at one point, and then the author feels really bad in case it was his fault. And so there's a whole kind of completely pointless thing going on at the bottom of the page, as well as the main story.
Tell us about the main story.
It is a time travel book, but travel is maybe the wrong word, because you don't go anywhere in Jeremiah Bourne. You stay exactly where you are, but backwards. So it's that phenomenon where you've mislaid something, and in fact you discover it's actually been there all along, staring at you, your phone or something. You thought you left it on the table. And time travel in Jeremiah Bourne is like that. You just suddenly notice the past and you're there, it's there. It's a memory skill, but not memory as in conscious memory. It's more to do with inherited memory. I've always been interested in what some people call morphic resonance. It's the collective memory. What have we got that we can know, but we don't consciously know it? Why do birds know how to fly south? Why do beavers? I don't know if you saw that video. There was a little beaver who'd been brought up away from rivers, away from other beavers. And as soon as he could walk, he started building a dam in a flat in New York, finding any old, teddies, records, anything he could find, and he built a dam with it. How did he know how to do that? He had no previous education on it. And I think there's a lot of us that is like that. We have stuff that we know that we can remember, but as yet we don't have a scientific explanation as to why we can remember that.
And why are taxi drivers' brains in London slightly different shapes than everyone else's?
Well, they're reputed to be bigger, a taxi driver, because a London black cab driver has had to do the knowledge to qualify to be a taxi driver, which means they have to know every single street in London. They spend years learning this and remembering it. And the theory is their hippocampi actually are bigger. And so I imagine a world in the future, because Jeremiah Bourne takes place in the same place, but in 1910, in 2019, and in 2123. It's in the same part of London. In fact, most of it is in the same house. Mm. And so I imagine a future in which memories become very important again, because there's been a digital meltdown and the human race has lost all of its data, which I find a very fun idea.
And it's part one of a three-book series.
It is indeed. It on the cover it says, part one of the Time Shard Chronicles, which is very generous of my publisher to have put that on the cover. I haven't actually written the second and the third one yet, but I do have a plan. I've got quite a lot of the character. I'm sort of ready to start actually doing a first draft of the second book. And the third one I've got a vague idea of as well, but I won't know more until I've finished the second one.
You know that thing when you're looking for something and you just can't find it, but it was right there in front of you, staring you in the face all along, and you just sort of blanked it out? Well, the past is like that. It happened. It's real, and it's never going to not have happened. It's been there all along, and then somehow you just notice it for the first time. Well, that's what it felt like when I opened that old biscuit tin. It was like all the air in the tin had been trapped in there for 100 years, and now it was let out. And there were a couple of old photos in there. One of a tall woman with long hair who I thought I recognised, and the other of what looked like this room. Our basement, with a whole load of old ladies wearing strange robes sitting in a circle round a big table.
Anyone there? Are you there?
I see him. Speak to us.
I see him too. He is here.
Oh. And when you click through to the audio version of Jeremiah Bourne in Time, you get an audio drama of the book.
You get an audio drama that's also called Jeremiah Bourne in Time, but it's not really an audio drama of the book, because I wrote a rather crude first draft of the book years ago. And before I had a deal on it or anything, I was working for a company called Big Finish, who do all the Doctor Who audios. And I showed this very crude first draft and synopsis to them. And they said, well, we could do a four-part drama of that. Mm. Great. So we did. I wrote 4 hours. And it's got a fantastic cast: Celia Imrie, Tim McInerney, Sophie Thompson, I mean, and many other amazing actors.
And yourself.
And myself in it. It was good fun to do, but it's not of the book, because having done that, I carried on developing the book. Mm. And there's heaps more in the book that isn't in the audio drama. And the audio drama, because it was for Big Finish, is very much in the sort of, it's got Doctor Who music with it, you know. Mm. It's very much that. The more emphasis on the sci-fi. And in the book, by the time the book got finished, there's a lot more characters, especially in the future section. There's a whole plot going on in the future, and there's Jeremiah's aunt, who lives in the future and has to come keep rescuing him in his various mistakes he makes. The audio drama is really good, but it's only one strand of the plot, and the overall plot bears more resemblance, as I say, to a Terry Pratchett or even to a sort of Blackadder, because the history in Jeremiah Bourne in Time is pretty accurate. I'm making stuff up, obviously, but I'm not making up the possibility and the time, the atmosphere of the time and the people and what was going on and what they were thinking. Mm. Is all pretty on. It's more Blackadderish, as I say, than Terry Pratchettish. And of course, the audio drama, not wishing to turn people away from the audio drama, but it is only half the story. Mm. Also, actually, I am wishing to turn them away, because I would love to do a full audio book of the book, doing all the characters myself. Never mind Tim McInerney and Celia Imrie. I'll do them all.
What just happened?
What is your name, O spirit?
I'm Jeremiah Bourne. Who the hell are you?
Language, please, young man. You may be dead, but that is no reason not to mind your P's and Q's.
Quite right, Mrs. Stokes.
Where are you from, O spirit?
Blackfriars Road, London, SE1.
What did he say?
He said he is from around here, the Blackfriars.
No. How can that be? Remarkable.
What's going on? Is this some kind of joke?
As you can see, none of us are laughing, young man.
What can he tell us of the afterlife?
Is my husband there? In the hereafter, his name was Ebenezer. Ebenezer Tandy. Do you know him?
And mine. Mr. Stipples. Tell him I've not forgiven
him. And my dear brother Charlie, is he there? He was such a lovely boy. Ladies, please, one at a time. Jeremiah, thank you for visiting us. We were expecting one Petrock Grimstead, a fisherman from 17th century Cornwall. That's who was summoned, but you will have to do. So, how was your journey?
I don't know. I just opened this old biscuit tin. There were a couple of photos in it. And then, whoosh!
Tell us, from which century do you hail?
21st, of course.
Now, you're at the Wigtown Book Festival, both to talk about Jeremiah Bourne in time, but also you're giving a talk on someone who was your mentor, Faye Weldon.
Yes, that's right. Faye became a really dear friend from really just a fan letter that I sent her. Mm. I saw her talking on television. I'd read, obviously, several of her books, and I saw her talking on television, and I thought, that's exactly how I feel. That's exactly, you've got it exactly right. Can't even remember what it was, that programme. And so I wrote her a fan letter and she replied, and I replied to that, and she replied to that. And I started sending her my short stories that I'd written, and she replied and started to sort of educate me a bit. And then we became friends socially. And then I came up with the idea. I was looking around. I wanted to write a piece of musical theatre. And I thought the only sort of, you need a brand name with a musical, if you want to do a musical. And the only thing I know and I'm close to is Life and Loves of a She-Devil. Mm. And so I spent, a year discussing that with her. What would be the right ending, for instance? Can you have an ending for a musical where one of the characters dies of cancer? Is that possible? Is it, or should, has it all got to be happy, happy? Mm. You know, how much of the plot would we keep? How much would we change? And then I teamed up with an old friend of mine who was in the musical We Will Rock You with me, Hannah Jane Fox, who played Scaramouche in that. And she happens to be a brilliant songwriter and composer with Andrew Holdsworth. They're a team. Mm. And the three of us spent quite some time. We wrote a musical's version of it, always reporting back to Faye, but quite worried because we were changing it. We brought it up into the modern day, so people have followers and there's digital media. And I'm so relieved. It never came to a full production, but I'm so relieved. We went to an extended workshop production, fully cast with an audience in a hall. Mm. No costumes and no set, just a piano, but to do the show as a workshop production. And thank God she made it to that, and she was absolutely delighted with it. And thank God. Because that would have been a disaster, wouldn't it, if she'd hated it. But no, she was very pleased with what we'd done. For dramatic purposes, we'd slightly changed, not changed the ending, the same events happen, everything's the same. Sort of the meaning behind them, we slightly changed because for theatre purposes, we dipped heavily into the Dr. Faustus legend as well. Because after all, Ruth, the main character, summons the devil and becomes the She-Devil. That's what she does. And we figured for theatrical purposes, it would be good if at the end she went to hell. And then we took a line which actually comes from Dr. Faustus. We give it to the plastic surgeon, where he says, oh, didn't you realise this is hell? You're in it. To Dr. Faustus. Mm. You're saying you think it's all hellfire. No, you're in it. You've created it.
Mm.
You create your own hell. Hell is what you make it. That's one of our songs. Hell is what you make it. You make your own hell bit by bit. And that kind of slightly 16th century moralising aspect of it is not in the original book. I mean, that's an imposition I think we've made, but it does make for more breathtaking theatre, because you need to know that hell is there. you need to know that when you can't just summon a devil on stage and then carry on. You know, you summon a devil, hell is there, you know.
Thanks once again to Nigel Planer. The audio version of Jeremiah Born in Time is available to buy commercially, and there are many books narrated by Nigel Planer in the RNIB library, where you'll also find Faye Weldon's Lives and Loves of a She-Devil. And in addition to that, these two brand new books.
New in the library from Simon & Schuster, we have the latest book by actor and comedian Bob Mortimer. It's called The Hotel Avocado.
If you've never heard of The Hotel Avocado, then you are way behind me. Miles back, in fact. If you have heard of it, then well done you. But don't go getting all pumped up about it, because I've actually seen it. I see it most days. Sometimes from the pavement as I walk past, sometimes from the bus stop opposite when I'm having my lunch. To be honest, I'll take any vantage point I can. I'm not fussy like some people. There is a chance that you're someone that has seen it for yourself, in which case we are hashtag equals. Better still, of course, you might be someone who's been inside or even stayed at the hotel. If that's the case, then I have to concede that you are an avocado scholar compared to me. Yes, I've glanced through the front door and some of its windows, so I want credit for that. But I've never set foot over its threshold. That would be the dream. Maybe one day.
Gary Thorne is struggling with a big decision. Should he stay in London, wallowing in the safety of his legal job in Peckham and eating pies with his next-door neighbour Grace and her dog Lasso? Or should he move to Brighton, where his girlfriend Emily is about to open the Hotel Avocado? Either way, he'd been letting somebody down. But sinister forces are gathering in the cloud of laundrette-scented vape smoke, and the arrival of the mysterious Mr. Sequence puts Gary in an even worse predicament. Soon, he might be dead. All Gary wants is a happy life, but he also wants to be alive to enjoy it.
For those who are coming to it all ignorant and innocent, let me add some paint to the picture. The hotel is second from the end of a long terrace of hotels and apartment buildings directly facing the sea on the promenade of my town called Brighton on the south coast of England. It's a big five-storey Victorian stuccoed building painted a yellowy magnolia and nestled between two identically designed buildings, the Royal Hotel to the left and the Hove View Apartments on the end plot to the right. I doubt you'll have heard of either of these places. I hardly ever give them a second look. If you have heard of them, or better still, have an association with either of them, perhaps you could tell them to apply a lick of paint and get the windows cleaned. If they do that, I might give them a second chance. Probably won't, though.
The Hotel Avocado by Bob Mortimer is read by Bob Mortimer with Sally Phillips, Paul Whitehouse and Julie Maisie, and runs for 9 hours and 20 minutes.
For those who enjoy cosy crime, we have Miss Beaton's Murder Agency by Josie Lloyd, which was given to us by HarperCollins.
I told you, it was the handsome professor. Alice Beaton shut the hardback library book with a satisfied snap. Never trust a man with a dimple in his chin. The kettle trilled like an old-fashioned police whistle. Alice walked across the small kitchen to turn off the gas, releasing the cap so that it gasped, the boiling water inside fizzing. Agatha barked once in reply, her bright brown eyes staring up at Alice, who now took a china cup and two saucers from the cupboard moving the remaining crockery a fraction to retain their pleasingly neat stacks. With a silver spoon, she measured out the precise amount of Earl Grey tea leaves from the caddy into the teapot, before filling it up from the kettle and placing a knitted cosy on top. As a self-confessed addict of crime fiction, Alice loved the twisty plots, red herrings and scattered clues that invariably resulted in her outsmarting most fictional detectives, with the exception of Miss Marple, of course. She had a prized set of all 80 Agatha Christies, after whom she'd named her dog, but she'd run out of space for any more books.
Alice Beaton never meant to wind up single and childless on the wrong side of 50, like her distant relative, Mrs. Beaton. Yes, that Mrs. Beaton. She had hoped to have her own spick and span household by now. In reality, she lives in an immaculate but dingy basement flat in a rather shabby block in Kensington, with Agatha, her fiercely intelligent, if rather over-territorial, corgi Jack Russell Cross. Now Alice runs the Good Household Management Agency, providing discreet domestic staff to extravagant townhouses and sprawling country piles. So when Camille Messon calls in urgent need of a new housekeeper, Miss Beaton sends out the new hire, Enya. She's rather forward, but she does come with impeccable references. But in the early hours of New Year's Day, Alice is rudely awakened with the news that Enya has been found dead, as the intriguing, if somewhat scruffy, Detective Rigby struggles to drum up an adequate investigation, and the wealthy family and their party guests close ranks. Miss Beaton takes it upon herself to solve the crime.
Alice's basement flat was never at its best early in the day, only brightening up when the sun was above the buildings opposite. Pulling up the Roman blind above the sink and peering up through the barred windows to street level, she noticed the weak, grey shimmer of the December sky. But the beast from the east that was predicted had yet to arrive. It really didn't look like it was going to snow, but you could never be too sure. Nevertheless, it was definitely a day for a thermal vest. On the table, trumpets of orange amaryllis that one of her grateful clients had sent filled the kitchen with a cheery dash of exotic colour. But despite everything being just right in her flat, it was hard to ignore the loud neighbours upstairs. She winced as that dratted son of theirs bounced a ball across her ceiling. She flicked on the radio and turned up the blast of Vivaldi as a riposte. Agatha barked again and tipped her head to one side. "I'm doing it," Alice said. "Be patient."
Miss Beaton's Murder Agency by Josie Lloyd is read by Emily Pennant-Ree and includes a chat with Josie Lloyd. The full running time is 10 hours and 39 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And finally on today's show, let's get the books of your life from comedian Richard Herring. Richard appeared on Read On, then, a few months later, had his own book podcast. I'm not saying the two are related, but here are the books of his life. Now, Richard, is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
There are quite a lot. I wasn't a voracious reader, and I kind of pretended to read things a lot when I was a kid. I remembered pretending I'd read all of the Dr. Dolittle series, and I quite liked Dr. Dolittle, but I kind of gave, you know, we had all of them, I think, that were handed down from my brother. I did really like it. It was funny. I was into funny things all the time, and so, like, I liked TV and shows, really, and puppet shows and stuff like that. And when I got a book token for Christmas, I remember my dad being very upset that I bought Peanuts Charlie Brown book. But, I was very into sort of comedy. And, you know, if I was lying and pretending I read books more than I did, I'd say Dr. Dolittle, which is a fantastic idea and a great series. But I think really I probably put more towards Asterix and Peanuts and things like that that weren't proper books according to my academic parents.
one day that the doctor was sitting in his kitchen, talking with the cat's meat man, who'd come to see him with a stomachache. "Why don't you give up being a people's doctor and be an animal doctor?" asked the cat's meat man. The parrot, Polynesia, was sitting in the window looking out at the rain and singing a sailor song to herself. She stopped singing and started to listen. "You see, doctor," the cat's meat man went on, "you know all about animals, much more than what these here vets do. That book you wrote about cats, why, it's wonderful. I can't read or write myself, or maybe I'd write some books, but my wife, Theodosia, she's a scholar, she is, and she read your book to me. Well, it's wonderful, that's all that can be said, wonderful. You might have been a cat yourself. You know the way they think."
Dr. Dolittle, or to give it its full title, The Story of Dr. Dolittle, being the history of his peculiar life at home and astonishing adventures in foreign parts never before printed, by Hugh Lofting, is available commercially in audio and from RNIB. The RNIB version is read by David Dunhill. And is there a book that on a rainy day you go back to again and again?
I mean, I think as an adult, I mean, sadly, I'm going to go for another cartoon book. But the books that really make me laugh and the book that kind of had most influence me on me as an adult becoming a comedian is The Far Side by Gary Larson, which is, you won't have an audio book of, which is another book of cartoons, which I do go back to. And I guess Margaret Atwood's stuff is always worth going back to. And I've read The Handmaid's Tale a couple of times. I've listened to the audio book and The Testaments and Oryx and Crake. And I think she's a really engaging, brilliant author. Probably my full answer, though, is going to be Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut, which I haven't yet listened to on audiobook, but I've read several times. I've listened to Breakfast of Champions, which is read by John Malkovich. As John Malkovich reads it, and it's really great. He has to describe the pictures in Breakfast of Champions, which he does in a kind of wonderfully world-weary way. When she reads the whole book in this very world weary way. And that Kurt Vonnegut's my favourite author, I think, overall. Just sort of genius.
Listen, Trout and Hoover were citizens of the United States of America, a country which was called America for short. This was their national anthem, which was pure balderdash, like so much they were expected to take seriously. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming? Whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming? And the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave? Or the land of the free and the home of the brave. There were 1 quadrillion nations in the universe, but the nation Duane Hoover and Kilgore Trout belonged to was the only one with a national anthem, which was gibberish sprinkled with question marks. Here is what their flag looked like. And here is a drawing of the American flag, the stars and stripes.
John Malkovich reading Breakfast of Champions by Kurt Vonnegut, which is only available from Audible. The Kurt Vonnegut books Slaughterhouse-Five, Cat's Cradle and Bluebeard are all available from RNIB. And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to recommend?
I read Craig Brown's book about the Beatles, 1, 2, 3, 4, I believe it's called. And absolutely excellent, you know, with the subjects that's been covered so massively over the years to find new stuff. It's almost like reinventing the biography because it sort of whizzes around the periphery of the Beatles and you find out little bits about the lives of the people that touched their lives and who in turn had their lives touched by the Beatles. So you find out little bits about Jane Asher's dad and stuff like that. And then, but you know, people who the songs were based on. And so it's a really fun book, which is also, you know, there's a bit about Craig Brown going to see the Beatles houses and being quite funny about the the people doing the tours and how precious they are about all the information that they're giving out, which is all generally quite well-known information. And he gets into sort of like a little fight with one of them because he's recording the talk. So it's a very unusual book, but it was absolutely, you know, and it's quite a long book and I kind of whizzed through it in a week. I was away working on a film, so I had lots of time to read, and it just sort of filled up the time I was waiting to be on camera, and really good, really enjoyable. And even if you've read everything about the Beatles, I think there'll be stuff in there that you won't have thought about. And there's a bit where Paul McCartney, after Hamburg, Paul McCartney went back and worked in a factory and got offered a kind of middle management job and had to weigh up whether he was going to take that or go back and play in the Cavern with the Beatles at lunchtime, and he couldn't do both. And just kind of really fascinated by the idea of Paul McCartney making the other decision and how his life would have panned out if he'd made that choice. I think he made the right choice.
In the autumn of 1969, Paul began to feel nostalgic for the days when the Beatles were at their happiest. He felt that the only way to restore their lost sense of camaraderie was to go back on the road, turning up unannounced to play small halls in out-of-the-way places. I thought, that's what I miss, and what they miss too, playing. He mentioned his plan to Ringo and John. Ringo appeared to go along with it, but John replied, "You're daft," adding, "Anyway, I'm leaving the group. I want a divorce."
Mark McGann reading from 1234, The Beatles in Time by Craig Brown. It's also narrated by Kate Robbins and Craig Brown. It's available commercially, and thanks to HarperCollins, it's also available from RNIB. Richard Herring, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 400 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.